The Guardian.
The Guardian Books Podcast with Claire Armistead.
Nigerian independence. For some final words on independence, here is the Prime Minister of the Federation.
1960 is a very great year for Africa and for Nigeria.
On March 6, 1957, Kwame Nkrumah led the British West African colony of the Gold Coast to independence as the nation of Ghana. Ghana was the first black African nation to gain independence. Its achievement inspired independence movements across Africa in the years that followed.
And thus, Ghana, your beloved country, is free forever. From now on today, we must change our attitude, our minds. We must realize that from now on, we are no more a colonial, but a free and independent people.
The garden party at Government House was an informal farewell to British rule in Kenya. Jomo Kenyatta presented some of the guests to the Duke and Mr. Sands. An epoch of 68 years was closing, years in which a wilderness became a thriving country. At Nairobi, the Duke of Edinburgh and Mr. Kenyatta received the freedom of the city.
Uganda Independence Day, October the 9th, 1962. The drums you hear are those of the Kabaka, or the ruler of Buganda, the largest of four ancient kingdoms in equatorial East Africa. Together with 11 other districts, they form Uganda, bounded on the north by the Sudan, on the west by the Congo.
It is a tribute by Tanganyika to the British men and women who went to Uganda and transformed the country in a manner which has made it possible for us today to talk of the independence of Uganda.
At midnight, the Union Jack was lowered for the last time, and Kenya ceased to be a colony and became independent. Good luck to Kenya in her new role as an independent nation.
The English left behind the concept of one nation, a common language, English, and a government structure based on the parliamentary system.
In 80 years, the people of Kenya had been on a difficult journey that took them from freedom to colonialism to independence. The future of Africa was at last back in African hands.
There is a new African in the world. That new African is ready to fight his own battle and show that after all, the black man is capable of managing his own affairs.
Half a century has passed since the great swoosh of African countries towards independence reached its peak. In the first 3 years of the 1960s, no fewer than 25 countries were given their freedom, including Nigeria, Congo, Kenya, and Tanzania, to give them their post-colonial names. Among the writers who came to prominence in that first flush were Kenya's Ngugi Wa Thiong'o and Nigeria's Chinua Achebe. Achebe is still kicking up a stink today. Only this week, he once again refused an honour from his native country. But these are the elder statesmen, and it's a new post-post-colonial generation that is now taking up the story. Among them, the Kenyan writer Binyavanga Wainaina, whose memoir, One Day I Will Write About This Place, is just out from Granta. Here he is reading from the book.
When I got into the matatu this morning, the conductor, a young, shabbily dressed man, had been slapping the vehicle, eyes narrowed and shrewd, sometimes urging people on with a hand on the back, sometimes grabbing people from the side of the road, all the time in Kikuyu, bawdy and rustic, laughing hoarsely when somebody shrugged away in annoyance. We left, and he marinated chatter in Gikuyu, and in Gikuyu-accented English. We had just passed the police post at an industrial area when the driver turned to the young man sitting next to the door in the back seat of the 15-seat Nissan and addressed him in Kalenjin, and he replied in the same language. I was so startled I turned back, and his eyes caught mine, and he laughed, then broke into Kalenjin for the benefit of the passengers, swinging his chin to point at me, laughing softly, his smile now open and friendly, teasing rather than mocking. It is an excellent way to diffuse our present political tensions. He is telling us all is fine. He has good reasons to do this. There have been clashes between Kalenjins and their neighbors every election since 1992. It is marvelous to watch the man's body language, his expressions, his character even, change from language to language. He's a brush town guy, a Gikuyu Matatu guy in Gikuyu, and even in Kiswahili. When he speaks Kalenjin, his face is gentler, more humorous, ironic rather than sarcastic, conservative, shy eyes. By the time we pass Kabarak, the newer passengers are helped in with more courtliness and less rush, things piled on the roof. One older woman is helped in, his eyes respectful. Some frail old threads gather as the woman sitting next to me sighs long in the middle of saying something to the driver. Her shoulder slumps and she says, "I aliniuthi the," a sort of pulling in of saliva, a completely familiar movement, and one I haven't noticed since I left years ago. The thing about it is how complete it is, how Kenyan it is, not just the sound, but the way her neck swings, her shoulders move up the droop quickly as she says, "Oh, that man, he really offended me," her slack shoulders say. Even now, she can only soften and succumb to this offense, for like me or you, she suggests, we are vulnerable to being offended and being defeated by the offense. And this moves us all, for she has told us all, too, that she trusts our common reaction enough to know that we, too, would not pull up a wall of pride at offense or begin an escalation of conflict. We sigh with her. For a moment, we become a common personality, and she's chatting back and forth with people all over the matatu.
Wainaina's memoir was born out of a scathing satire in Granta, How to Write About Africa. "Always include Africa, darkness or safari in your title," he thundered. "Make sure you show how Africans have music and rhythm deep in their souls. And always end your book with Nelson Mandela saying something about rainbows or renaissances because you care." He talked to Richard Lee about why we should stop treating the new generation of African writers like an exotic species. In this book, a fictionalized memoir, he's gone over the same ground as an earlier short story. He told Richard why.
I'd gone through a cycle of style and I was bored with it. And so I thought I'd use this book to sort of stretch some of the things I wanted to do with language and style. And at the time, it was just those things, you've won a prize and people are rushing at you. And then you're like, yes, 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 I can write the big African novel or something.
So it's kind of a question of artistic experimentation in terms of the way you were writing. And so you wanted to have something that you were comfortable with in terms of the material.
I had been some kind of apprentice. I was reading other people's stuff and thinking through things. I'd been ready for a while to kind of break through and build my own vehicle, my own language, my own style. So this was just like, oh, great, you know, now I can do that, yeah.
There's a whole lot of politics in the book. There's the death of Kenyatta, there's the rise of Moi, the fall of apartheid, there's the massacres in Rwanda, but they're all off stage, always glimpsed on TV somewhere else. Did you want to keep this very much focused on the personal?
Yes. If you were to ask me what are the greatest issues in Africa, I'd say it is that people love, people fuck, people kiss, people speak, people have language and people have priorities, and that's the priority of everybody. And I'm acutely aware, as is pretty much any African writer, that but the moment you start saying things in English, as your book comes out and explain why you did not talk about female genital mutilation in Africa or Katin, the village that was adopted by Uganda, and all those things. And those are just not things I or we are really concerned about in the hierarchy of priorities. The politics are just because if you occupy space and time, presidents come, they go. But I was just trying to have sex in South Africa at 18 too, right? As was everybody who was 18 in South Africa. They were not sitting down beating their chests about the fall of apartheid.
There's a marvelous moment when Bob Geldof is glimpsed on television.
I was in high school when the world...
You mean Band-Aid?
The Band-Aid thing. And of course, we were watching Top of the Pops as everyone else was and tuning into BBC on shortwave. And so, like, all of a sudden, we are humming the song and we are singing. Of course, the Somalia is next door. Ethiopia is next door. And we are feeling, oh my goodness, Pop has spoken. We must speak too, and so on and so forth. But the truth was, the entry of that rhetoric in the 80s and into the 90s as things changed had its own profound influence on us, because this was the beginning of CNN, you know, and all these things. And we were sitting down as global citizens watching CNN say, Africa's done. Watching the most visible public figures in the world at the time, including Michael Jackson, who's black, and all those black people and all those people saying, it's over. It's like your experiment is over. We'd been living in this Kenya, going to school, being happy, planning to become doctors. And all of a sudden, by second form, third form, there was this thing coming saying, something's coming and you're going to be starving and dying. Someone's needing to come and save you from yourselves and from drought and from famine and from anything. We had a famine too, but mysteriously. So a certain language, the first kind of developmentalism, paternalism, help you, help me, Oxfam baby thing was starting. And unfortunately, Russia fell, and then it became embedded, the kind of pity thing, which I'll continue to say is something that every educated African finds great, great offense in. We are not interested. We are not interested in Oxfam. We are not interested in Tony Blair. We are not interested in what Oxfam is doing for Africa. We are not interested in what aid donors are doing. We are not interested in the partnership those people have with global media to be the voice of Africa to the world. We really are not. We never have been. We don't talk about it. We don't discuss it. We usually frequently look for high salaries. Hmm. Yeah.
Hmm. I think it's your father speaking, though it's not clear, that he says that everybody used to have many names, but these days, most times, your name's on is what's on your birth certificate. Mm-hmm. I was wondering if you use the name Kenneth anymore, and if not, where it's gone.
The name Kenneth is used by my late dad. He died in June. And my siblings and people who are in primary school with me, and some people who are in high school with me. Then in high school, I felt Pan-African somehow, and then became Binyavanga, and it kind of stuck. My mother used to call me Ken, happily that has disappeared. So it hovers, you know, it's my name.
It's your name there somewhere. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You also say you speak both English and Kiswahili.
Yes.
Which are official languages in Kenya, if that's, I'm right there.
Kind of. English is the official language of all documents and things. Kiswahili is what we call a national language, which is now studied in school and which we all speak. And it's one of those ways of getting around the fact that everybody else has their third or first language, depending on what you're talking about. We have, I guess, between 50 and 70, depending on what you define as a language. Mm. I write in English because I read English books or books in English. All Africans were in tribes. This came, I don't know, from the Romans or the British or something. So we were brought up saying that these are the tribes. How they chose to manage those tribes, what jobs you took in the army, in the colonial government. So certain tribes did these ones misbehave, but they're very entrepreneurial. That stuck. Certain tribes were consolidated together and given one brand, Kalenjin, Luya, and that stuck. when you negotiate your way into independence, you negotiate as that group. Much as sometimes you don't even share a common language, but you are in the same tribe. There are tribes of 100 people. There are tribes of 50 million in Africa. So when I'm talking about identity, tribal identity is part of the political identity of Kenya in how politics plays out pre and post-independence, in how these areas were governed pre and post-independence, in how these areas have failed to fully decolonize pre and post-independence. So I may love you from a different tribe and we are lovers and we have sex and we have children and we are best friends and so on and so forth, and an election comes and all of a sudden you're on different sides of something. And I'm really interested in that. I'm really interested in language. I'm really interested in the fact that in Kenya, where you use English, you will use English when you want to express authority over somebody. We'll use your mother tongue when you need to express some kind of brotherhood with somebody. And in Kiswahili, that's the language of a kind of love, because we don't have a colonial relationship with Kiswahili.
A kind of nation-building brotherhood.
Yeah, a kind of nation-building brotherhood.
Kind of all together now brotherhood.
Yeah. And that's how we use those languages and that's how we interact as a nation. So this is very specific to not only our colonial experience, but our political history post-independence.
One of the things that you're doing in the book is searching for ways in which to understand what those other languages mean to you. There's the word Kime that you invent, which, if I've understood it correctly, is the other languages out there which are sounding different to your own languages.
The word came to me and I used it in myself. I think with my sister, who we're very close with, we used to giggle. It's a giggle word, but it was an invented word. And to me, it was many things. It was accordions, which I hated. Things that wobbly things. Things that just kind of shook the world in weird ways. I really hated trumpets, the sound of jazz. This was the 70s. There was all this kind of like Jimi Hendrix-y things. I hated traditional music of all ethnicities that we used to see on TV during national event days. And part of what I wanted to do was really kind of discuss the texture of that world. It's shakeability. So that's what Kime is.
There's a marvelous kind of reveling in the differences, the particularities. Did you have your own ironic advice from your grantor piece about treating Africa as if it were one country? Did you have that advice ringing in your ears as you were writing?
No. My job wasn't to police you. It was a tongue-in-cheek thing that anybody who's brought up consuming Western media, Western fiction, and Western things about Africa, which all of us do, and which people in the West don't get. The imagination is when a book is reviewed, they say we. They're assuming a certain we that doesn't include them. But remember, Britain had many colonies. And even just the trash of Britain lands in those colonies, leaving alone the good things. They're in our bookshops, they're in our imaginations, they're in our lives. So we consume them just like they're consumed here. And the average British reader has not got the beginning of a way to conceive of you. And I think that's a challenge of the writers of our generation. It's not whether we care about the average British reader, but it's a prose challenge to create codes that are more universal. You'd struggle to find any significant books that come out of Britain about us. And so it becomes a question of how and why Britain itself has not been able to produce literature that's global, even though it had a global empire. It is producing really amazing work that can speak to the diversity within Britain. I can read it because I'm familiarized, but as a writer, I recognize that it's still indigestible. And there are Kenyans who are English-speaking Kenyans and educated Kenyans who will not and cannot get the codes. But we now get the codes of American stuff. But
because it's everywhere in Hollywood, on the TV.
So the generation of my dad could have gotten the English codes. We can't anymore. Yeah.
I'm wondering if people have stopped asking you to read their stuff after your second article about how to write about Africa. If people have stopped asking you to police their stuff to give you the seal of approval on there.
Now the Americans are discovering and they're, oh my God. But now they're calling it how not to write about Africa, because when you say I would write about Africa, ironically, that just isn't American enough. But the point about it is that it hits the guilt button, as opposed to the thinking button. It hits reactions rather than actions. And so it was there for people to think about and talk about and engage with. And it sort of freezes people like deer in the headlight. And then they're like, oh, God. I even got once a call from somebody in Oxfam who was like, they wanted me to advise. To what? That advise what? Why would you need advising? You're doing what you do. You're funded by the British government. It helps Britain look good. It helps you feel good. It doesn't really make my world a better place. You know that. What this whole world does not do is it does not engage us and our brains. It just comes with little kind of patronizing bullet points to a planet. And then you sit as a writer with somebody across, you know, some microphone. And then they're like, explain to me how. And then I'm like, shit, I'm now back in kindergarten. As many Africans always feel, you're in kindergarten explaining yourself to somebody who wants to receive kindergarten things. And then they want to tell you their heart is good. And I'm like, I don't care if your heart is good. I don't care if it's bad. That's not what the conversation's about.
Binyavanga Wainaina's One Day I Will Write About This Place. It's published by Granter. The book's an enlargement of a story that won Wainaina the Kane Prize for African Writing. So with us in the studio is the administrator of that prize, Lizzie Attree, along with another former Kane winner, Brian Chikwava, and John Vidal, our very own environment editor, who has just returned from 3 weeks, going through several countries in Africa.
Going through many, 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 many countries. I went from north to south.
So we better fess up, John. We're both children of the evil empire, aren't we? We were both born in Africa. I was born in Nigeria.
I'm a Ghana man, but I moved to Nigeria when I was three, so I hardly remember Ghana.
What's your connection, Lizzie?
My family worked in Africa, in Nigeria as well. My father worked in Nigeria and the Gambia before I was born. And so I grew up hearing stories of both places. And I decided after doing a degree in English literature at Manchester that I hadn't actually been taught anything about African literature, so I would do an MA to find out more. And so I did that at SOAS, and I've been hooked ever since.
And Brian, you're from Zimbabwe. How come you're here? Are you based in London now?
Yeah, I'm based in London. I decided to relocate. That was in 2003. I just needed a new environment where I can write without, any difficulties that maybe writers faced in Zimbabwe there.
And you hit the scene, you hit the ground running, actually, with Harare North a couple of years ago, didn't you?
Yeah, probably not hit the ground running like that. Trying to learn the craft in a way through short stories, and then eventually got there.
Wainaina said some really interesting things in the interview we've just heard, and I want to go through some of them. One of the things he said was, "I was just trying to have sex in South Africa like everyone else." Brian, I'm not. He wasn't. He objected the idea that actually what young African writers want to do is write about big themes or political things. How do you respond to that?
I think it is a fair point because among a lot of young writers, there is a part of, say, the contemporary African, say, urban life that they feel has not been extensively explored. And a lot of them, I think now, in this kind of globalized world, they really feel they need to explore that in their own ways. And so there is a bit of that, really.
John, it's not only in short stories, is it, that African writers are sort of doing new things and wanting to find their own ground?
I was at a huge international African journalist conference in South Africa, and they brought in people from all over Africa. I was astonished at some of the standard of the journalism which was now coming out, the breadth of it, the scale of it, the depth of it. It was really exciting. It was stuff which I didn't think I had seen before. And there was a real spirit of a pan-African desire to raise the level of journalism.
What about poetry?
Well, I was in Lagos the other day, Port Harcourt, and found the poetry of oil coming out. So the resistance to the, if you like, the new colonialism of the oil companies, of the land grab companies, or whatever, is now beginning to express itself. And I think that's what we found everywhere we went, was that there were these small groups of people who were beginning to express themselves in very, very different ways.
Well, let's return now to the short story, because both Brian and Wainaina have short stories in a new anthology of work by African writers born after 1960, and it's edited by Helen Habila, who's Nigerian. And Habila describes these writers as the post-nationalist generation, liberating themselves from the almost obligatory obsession of the African writer with the nation and national politics, which is slightly bringing up our previous point. Lizzie, what do you say to this? Is this something that you see in the entries for the Kane Prize?
Well, it's a difficult one to pin down quite so precisely. I think it's a really useful rubric for academics and for Habila to kind of draw those stories together. But I think it does help us in a way to see that, you know, we've gone beyond the traditional political concerns of the previous generation. But to go back to what Wainaina was saying, you know, in writing about sex, I think I'm about to go to a conference in Johannesburg, and my panel will be called From Africa with Love, and it's talking about, again, post-nationalist writing. And I think, you know, writing about sex, desire, the politics of the self, sexuality, modern existence in Africa, the cosmopolitan, the diaspora experience, these are all subjects which I think writers in that collection that Habila has edited are concerned with, and who perhaps have always written, you know, in that way. It's just been ignored by some of the academics, or perhaps not picked up on as much as the political themes. I remember meeting Wally Sorota a number of years ago, the South African poet, and when he was asked why he wrote poetry, and this is back in the apartheid days when everything was meant to be so politicised, he said he wrote to impress women. And that was, you know, I think that's one of the reasons behind most poets' reasons for writing. And I think one of the interesting things about Binyavanga's book itself is that he's not just grappling with the big subjects about identity and the experience that he's trying to process in that book, but he's just trying to grapple with the idea of being a writer and an artist himself. And I think, you know, from Joyce to Beckett to Dylan Thomas, everybody is doing that in a way, and that those are the big struggles that he deals with. And by the end of the book, he announces that, you know, he will write about this place, and that's exactly what he does.
Going back to that anthology, several of these writers have won the Kane Prize, haven't
that's
they?
That's right, yeah, Habila himself actually won in 2001.
And Uem Akpan, did he win it?
No, he was shortlisted, but he's one of those alumni that's gone way beyond the Kane. He got picked up by Oprah on her book club.
We longlisted him for the Guardian Prize, and then were
absolutely
very, very pleased to see that Oprah followed suit.
Yeah.
Now, he is a political writer, isn't he? I mean, that short story collection covers genocide, corruption, all sorts of things.
That's a really interesting collection because actually I think it's only three or four stories. There's a very long story which is the most kind of heartbreaking and notable in that collection about the children who were hiding in a house in Rwanda during the genocide.
Say You're One of Them, that is the title story.
That's the title of the book. Well, he's a very interesting character. He's actually a Jesuit priest. And so his concerns, I think, although political, I think he's in a way he's really trying to get to the heart of fear in that story and into the mind of a child. It's actually almost, even though the situation is so highly politicised, it's almost not a political story. It's very much it's set in the heart of the family, like a particular experience. It's kind of drenched in blood. It's horrific in part, but it's also an exploration for someone, you know, from his background, a Nigerian, to explore the Rwandan experience. It's kind of an interesting approach, I think, perhaps, for which, you know, so many other people have written about the Rwandan genocide, but he approaches it from an entirely different perspective.
So this business of, is there such a thing as a pan-African sensibility? You mentioned the word pan-African. What do you think about that, Brian? I mean, it's such a huge continent. How can we possibly talk about an African literature?
It is quite a hard one because people, I think, are a lot more aware of the world and what is happening in other parts of the world. And because of that, you tend to find that probably now the average African would know, say, about what is happening in India, in Asia, in Latin America, and people always want to kind of juxtapose their experiences. And obviously, because of that, really, Pan-Africanism becomes, I don't know, less relevant in a way, because the world has become smaller and people tend to see it that way.
Lizzie, In her review of the anthology that we were talking about, Bernardine Evaristo said a disproportionately high number of them were refracted through European or American prism.
I mean, one of the difficulties, especially even at the Kane Prize that we have, is that many of the writers who are writing and who are successful at publishing from the West, so a proportion of those writers are based in the UK, as Brian is, and in America or in different countries in Europe. And I think that means that, you know, inevitably those stories come with that sort of lens through which they see their home countries. Sometimes that leads to incredible nostalgia and kind of, you know, many of the stories often depict childhood experiences, for example. But also I think they just bring with them different concerns. As Brian also said, you know, the globalised issue, the sort of context is shifted from the duology of the colonial encounter to a much wider sort of sense of connection between America and Nigeria, for example, or Zimbabwe and Britain, but also, you know, that could include Muslim concerns in Zimbabwe or the Chinese, for example, who are a massive influence now, and the Asian influence in Africa. So there is that prism, but I don't think it's the exclusive, you know, view. And I think, you know, we're certainly looking for stories that still come out of Africa without using that cliche too lightly.
There is, then, it would seem, some sort of continuing relationship between Europe and Africa, at least as far as the imagination is concerned, and also as far as the wallet is concerned. One man who would second that is Bernardo Achaga, a Basque writing in both his own language and in Spanish, who feels the imperial pressures the more since his country is also struggling for self-determination. His latest novel, Seven Houses in France, is set in a colonial garrison in Congo. Here's Richard Lee again talking to him.
My desire wasn't to write about Africa or about Congo, but about Yangambi. Yangambi is a garrison, it's a place where military people is dominant, and this is the connection with my life and with my experience. I am more familiar with military life than the Congo, no, than the country, because I spent 1 year and a half in barracks, and also I live in Spain during the dictatorship, a very violent time, and also I am Basque. I have lived in a very strong relationship with violence. So for me, the subject, the main subject of the book is the military people, the military characters, and Yangambi is interesting for me because it's a garrison, I think.
For you, the new setting, the new book being set in Africa is not so important. It's a similar kind of novel to the novels you've been writing about Obaba, but just in a different place. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. Let me say something about the literary geographies. You think about this novel written by Stevenson, the famous novel written by Stevenson, The Treasure Island. This kind of geography is very useful for the writer because the island is very far, so it's not close to Edinburgh, so there is a very big space. And also, and this is maybe the most important point, and also these kind of islands have a legend, I mean pirates and ships and so on, no? So it's very useful for the authors to have this kind of geographies, and me too, and also at the same time a place with a legend. In this case, the legend was a black legend, a dark legend, of course, and it's a legend linked to the European martyrs, the martyrs as King Leopold of Belgium. So I take into account this legend in order to write better about power, about monsters, about criminals, about the language of these, of those criminals.
As part of the legend, as you put it, of this novel rooted in Europe but examining Africa, as part of this legend of Africa was the work of Joseph Conrad. I'm thinking of The Heart of Darkness. Was this part of the legend that you were dealing with in this novel?
Yes, of course, I was aware of the most quoted book about colonialism and so on. But my preceding spirit when I was writing this book wasn't Joseph Conrad, but Jonathan Swift. Mainly his pamphlet called, you know, The Modest Proposal, the second, the almost nobody remember, the pamphlet written by Mark Twain about King Leopold of Belgium, and a pamphlet called King Leopold's Soliloquy.
It's not a text I'm familiar with. What does he argue in the text?
More or less is the worst criminal vermin that ever existed in the world doesn't live in a cave, but in the Royal Palace of Belgium. Even Arthur Conan Doyle, he also wrote a pamphlet against the King Leopold.
You're scathing about the brutality, the exploitation of colonialism, but you're also drawing a very unflattering picture of military life.
I think that I try to fight against heroes. For me, heroes are very, very dangerous people because they don't understand the death. No? And I remember there is a memorial in Washington, the memorial of the war of Vietnam, and they are two different monuments. One of them is a military monument with, you know, soldiers raising the flag in the top of the hill and so on. No? In the other side, there is a wall with a thousand and thousand names of the fallen soldiers in Vietnam. Just the names are the date. And I think that this second monument, made by relatives, of course, not by military people, this is the truth of our situation.
Seven Houses in France is published by Vintage. Now, John, Lizzie and Brian are still with me. Chinua Achebe, who I mentioned earlier, told The Guardian back in 2003 that he wanted no more books like Conrad's Heart of Darkness because his humanity is not to be debated, nor is it to be used to illustrate European problems. Is that what Achaga is doing? Is Achaga just waded straight back into the Badlands?
One of the things we should celebrate is not, you know, what is Africa and try and find an answer, but that we're all interested in the question and we would love to hear everybody's experience and version of Africa. And it's up to you, you know, where that leaves you in terms of whether you feel that you've answered the question or not. But we're interested in the question, absolutely. And the more writing and the more experimentation that goes on in exploring that question, the better, I think.
Well, yeah. Let's not forget that, as Evaristo said at the end of her review, it has been an unprecedented decade for African fiction, which we should all, I guess, celebrate around this table. Thank you very much for coming in. John, there's one last quote from one of our readers responding to the Chinua Achebe story, which I mentioned at the beginning, about him turning down the President's Medal from Nigeria. I wonder if you'd read that.
Chinua Achebe and Gujibwa Tionga, two notable writers of the Third World who have revolutionised the post-colonial literature and its inclusion as part of world literature. Achebe's yearning for corruption-free Nigeria is a laudable one. His gesture may boost the new generation writers' morale to focus on ethical issues.
So, perhaps we should actually go to an African literary festival next year, because there are so many literatures we haven't even touched on. We haven't talked about African writing in other colonial languages, such as Portuguese and French. Can any of you make comments and suggestions about these? If so, write them in the comments section on the page beneath this podcast. If you've come to us through iTunes, you'll find us at guardian.co.uk/books. Click on the podcast button at the top of the page. Tell your friends and fellow readers too to listen in, or even subscribe at the same place. So what else can we recommend this coming week? We've hauled Richard Lee back into the studio to give us the lowdown. Richard.
Yes, this Saturday in Saturday Review, Alexander McCall-Smith, John Banville, Minette Walters and Julian Fellows imagine secret stories behind the mystery portraits in the National Portrait Gallery, while Razia Iqbal goes to Egypt and talks to writers and booksellers about the unfinished revolution. In The Observer on Sunday, there's an interview with Noel Fielding, who featured on this very podcast a little while back. And on Tuesday, we're starting a new series of articles about writers' desktops and what they find on their computer when they switch it on.
Oh, I wouldn't like mine to be made public, I have to say. Thanks very much, Richard. Thanks also to Lizzie Attree, John Vidal and Brian Chikwava, and to our authors Binyavanga Wainaina and Bernardo Achaga. I'm Claire Armistead. From me and my producer, Tim Mabey, goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.